comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you happen to be all around this gorgeous place we call Earth, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, the show where you matter. Now, we had a very interesting and challenging weekend. Our members already know about this because I've sent them a special email. That's one of the benefits of being a member, by the way, is we keep you up to date on the inside scoop, what's going on here. But I mean, it was a tough weekend, and we'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow night and kind of let the rest of you in on it. Tomorrow is our 10th anniversary at the Kevin Smith Show. It was on May the 11th back in 2000. When I put the very first Kevin Smith Show broadcast online, and we were off and running, and I can't say we were off the porch and running with the big dogs, but we are now, but at least we were off and running. And tomorrow's our 11th year anniversary, so we're going to do something a little different and a little bit special tomorrow. And I think you will enjoy that. I hope you will. Now, if you are not already subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, you got to ask yourself this question. Where is the genius in that? There's no genius in that. And, you know, the genius is in subscribing. It's free. I mean, and we don't speak in DC speak, okay? We speak in English. So free means free. And there are no strings attached. So just go over to my website. You'll see where it says K-Files. Click on it. And you can subscribe in a matter of seconds. And then you'll start getting our free weekly newsletter. And you'll be in the know instead of in the dark. And in the know is much, much better than in the dark. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. There's a link in every edition where it says, if you don't want to get this anymore, click here. And you click there and unsubscribe. Most people don't. Most people stay with us forever. In fact, we have some who have, some K-Files subscribers who have been with us since we first started putting out the K-Files. And we started in 2000 in Kosovo. So we've got some people that have been with us all the way from Kosovo till today. And tomorrow night, we're going to ask some of our folks that have been with us all the way since Kosovo to call in. If you remember hearing us, you remember hearing the show back when I was in Kosovo when we first started, then we're going to want you to call in tomorrow night and let us know about that, okay? And what you remember about the show and what you liked best about the show and so forth. So we'll be doing that tomorrow night. All right, tonight my guest is someone known to everybody. If you're interested in UFOs, then you know you know my guest. His name is Bill Burns. You've seen him on television on a show called UFO Hunter. And some of you know him from UFO Magazine. There's a whole lot about Bill Burns, though, that I bet you don't know. And we'll get into that when we come back from this break. Don't go away. Thank you. and welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I stated, my guest this evening is Bill Burns. You are familiar with him, I know. Some of you are familiar because of his books, some of you are familiar because of UFO Magazine, some because of the television show UFO Hunters. Let me tell you a little bit about Bill Burns that some of it you know, some of it you don't. Bill Burns is not just a UFO guy. He has a law degree. He has a doctorate degree. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He is the co-host of Future Theater Radio. He is the lead host and consulting producer of the History Channel's UFO Hunters. He's an editor, a magazine and book publisher, New York literary publishing agent, book and television producer. He's written and edited over 25 books and encyclopedias in the fields of human behavior, true crime, current affairs, history, psychology, business, computing, and the paranormal. He has two forthcoming titles at Torforge Books and a nonfiction series in science and technology, as well as a psychology textbook at Taylor & Francis, due out in October 2010. There are many dimensions to Dr. William J. Burns. Bill, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Thank you, Kevin. It's really nice to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'll tell you what, I wish we had invited you earlier. I don't know why we hadn't, but I think I thought, well, you know, you're so busy with the TV show, you wouldn't have time. But I appreciate you giving us the time and coming on the show, and I know the audience appreciates it.
It is my pleasure.
Bill, I'm going to jump right into the deep end here, all right?
Sure.
You have a law degree. You have a PhD. Your many accomplishments as an author and a television producer show quite clearly that you have the ability to succeed at just about anything you decided to do. Now, most people with a pedigree like that tend to shy away from the whole idea of UFOs. And yet you do not seem to have any reticence at all in seriously investigating and discussing UFOs. Now, why do you think that is?
Well, it was really for the same reason that, I would say 15 years before I got involved with the whole UFO investigative field, that I got fascinated by this whole area of the psychology of true crime and the story of Ted Bundy and stories like that, John Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer. And the reason was and is that sometimes when you're looking for the truth about something, about our place on Earth, the nature of what humankind is, big questions like that. Where do we fit on this planet? How should we behave? What's the nature of the human mind? When you look for truths in that area, you find yourself going all the way to the edge of reality and not staying in the middle of reality, because it's on the edge where the truth is. For example, my part of my PhD is in the subject of linguistics, and it was in the neurological and psychological developmental foundation of language. That was part of my doctorate all the way back in the late 1960s. And when you begin studying things about the human brain and how the human brain works, you're kind of lured, even though you're doing specific things, right? Like, where is the seat of language in the human brain? Things like that. But you're lured from that by really much bigger issues. How did language begin on planet Earth? what's the nature of the asymmetry of the human brain that allows human beings to think about themselves, have kind of meta-thinking, the way animals don't have, or we believe animals don't have, is the structure of how the human brain developed, is that somehow related to the larger picture of language? And the more you delve into this, the more you begin asking basic questions about the nature of humanity, the nature of the human mind, is there a good and evil, and you find certain events, and that really takes you to the nature of humanity. So when Philip Corso, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, retired from the Army, came into my life in 1994, 1995, brought to me by a motion picture company with whom I was trying to develop a television series and develop a book about missing POWs from the Vietnam War. And Corso came in because he was the person who talked about missing POWs from the Korean War and why President Eisenhower signed off on the fact that they were missing. Suddenly, when Corso dropped the bomb about the Army had been involved in reverse engineering or making reverse engineering possible of UFO debris from the crash at Roswell, a lot of things clicked into place. Growing up in the 1950s, in the early 1950s, during the big UFO flaps over Washington, D.C., and the jets, and watching UFOs on Movie Tone News, and knowing about the myth of Roswell, the mythology of Roswell, you suddenly see this person who's talking about an event that really fascinated you when you were a child. So there's a reality here, so you really jump on that. And so that's how I became involved in it, because I believed there was a larger truth. Maybe it wasn't a truth about creatures from another planet. Maybe it wasn't extraterrestrials. Whatever it was, there was a larger truth, and it's the larger truth about existence that's always lured me in. And so that's how I became involved in UFOs.
Okay, so that leads us quite naturally then to the next question, which is, for the broader general public, you're probably best known to them for the TV show UFO Hunter, or perhaps for the documentary The Day After Roswell. So you've brought us very close to the answer to this question, but let's go over the finish line with this question. Why is UFO information, UFO investigation, UFO research, why is that important?
It's important for a couple of reasons. And on the one hand, I don't see the government stepping up and disclosing any information. I think that there's a natural tug of war between what the government, because it is a government, it's a bureaucracy. I don't even think there's a government per se. I think it's a bunch of different agencies that kind of work sometimes together, sometimes not. But there's no impetus for them to release any information that they don't have to. So that's on the one hand. So if you want to find out something that you think the government knows, that's the rationale for investigation in general. They just don't come up and say, well, here are things that we know and that you may not know, we're just going to tell you. They're just not going to do that. They haven't done that for over 100 years. Why would they start now? So that's the first thing. And then you'd say, well, why UFOs in general? Well, if they're, UFOs are part of a larger picture. If there are no, if the UFOs we believe are UFOs are actually military assets, military aircraft that are able to do some astounding things, then if I were the military, I certainly wouldn't disclose that unless I had to. Remember, the B-2 stealth bomber wasn't disclosed until the 1976 campaign for president between Jimmy Carter and Gerry Ford, and I think it was either that or 1980 between Carter and Reagan. And at one point in one of the debates, I believe it was Carter who dropped the bomb about there being a B-2 stealth bomber, and everybody was shocked that the president would disclose that. I mean, why disclose it? I mean, the Russians, I'm sure, already knew it, and sort of the Chinese, but why disclose it to the American people? And that was a shocker. Again, why do governments do that thing? So if flying triangles over Area 51, over Belgium, over Nevada are commonplace, and people are saying, well, these are extraterrestrial craft, but they're really not. They're really government planes. They're really government aircraft. The Hudson Valley sightings from the 1980s, if that's what they are, and the government is keeping it secret, well, so be it. We don't have to force them to tell the truth. However, we have the right to do any investigation we want to. And the big question isn't so much, or the big question after we figure out whether it's ours or theirs, ours being our military assets, theirs being some kind of craft from another world or another dimension, after we figure that out, and if we figure out that it's ours, the next question is, where did we get it? How did we get it? Who gave it to us? How did we develop this kind of craft? What is the technology history of this craft? So there's a rationale for investigation of just straight UFOs on that basis. But the larger picture, of course, is if there are craft from another reality, be it another planet, another solar system, another galaxy, another universe that's a parallel universe, or another time, then if that's the case, that says a lot about our place in the universe. And you realize that a lot of things that we believe just aren't true. For example, people are saying, well, someday we may discover life on other planets. Well, surprise, we discovered life on other planets maybe 30-some-odd years ago when we unearthed the pieces of the chunks of Mars that fell in the Arctic zones of Earth. And in those chunks of rock, we found carbonates. And carbonates are the end products of protein-based life. And sure enough, we then knew for a certainty that something from Mars had produced those carbonates, and whatever was producing them on Mars had fallen to Earth and was producing them here. So you, Kevin, and I, and all the people listening to us tonight are probably Martians, not Earthlings.
I don't have any problem with that at all. I really don't. But let's pause for just a moment and back up to something you said. You said we have the right to investigate anything we want to. Now, the first question I want to ask you is just yes or no. Do you really believe we have the right to investigate anything we want to?
Yes, I do.
Okay, second question.
The answer, but I think according to our Constitution, we have the right to pursue. We have the right to pursue a journalistic truth.
Okay, I agree with you. Now, today, you and I were speaking on the telephone. We talked for a total of 39 minutes and 33 seconds. For about the first 30 minutes, we talked without any problems whatsoever. Then the conversation turned to Dr. Lakhisar Filipov in Bulgaria, and I began to talk about that case. If you don't mind, share with the audience what happened.
It was fascinating because if most people who talk on cell phones know that when you are leaving an area, when you're between cell phone relays, that sometimes you lose the signal. And when you begin to lose signal, the voices get strange. Sometimes it is interrupted so that every third word. Well, we were having a very pleasant conversation for about 30-some-odd minutes, as you say, and suddenly when this, and it was a specific question, Kevin, wasn't it?
It was.
It was our conversation. We're talking generally about this person, right? And what
That's
he
right.
did and
mm-hmm.
subject of extraterrestrials on planet Earth and how he discovered that and how he disappeared for a period of days and then came back, and your analysis of his performance was that he was sleep deprived for a certain reason. And then we said, can you get to him? And you said it would certainly take some money to do that, money that I don't have. And we were, and I was about to say, and we were about to begin talking about what if we went there? And at that point, something interrupted our cell phone conversation such that you were completely broken up.
That's correct. Now, the interesting thing about that is I was not on a cell phone.
Well, isn't that fascinating?
I was on the cell phone that was broken up. I was on the same telephone line that I'm speaking to you on right now, which is not a cell phone. But this sort of thing happens, and it happens frequently. It has happened more and more frequently, and the attacks have been more intense in terms of this show since January of this year.
And what happened in January?
A lot of things happened. I can't pin it to one specific thing. But since January, the attacks against this show have intensified. And this isn't the only show. I've talked to some hosts of other shows. One of them told me on the air here that he was trying to conduct an interview for his show and was interrupted 26 times during the interview. So when we say we have a right to investigate, I agree. If we were to say that we have a right to freedom of speech, I agree with that. Our Constitution says so. But there now exists, and it's very prominent in the field of UFOs, there now exists, apparently, a group of people for whom the Constitution is a mere suggestion, if even that. And they don't want you to find out. They don't want me to find out. And whatever we find out, they don't want us to share it with our audiences.
You're absolutely right. That's 100% on the money. Not only don't they want you to find out, they will go to some extraordinary lengths, including homicide, to keep you from telling folks what you have discovered that they don't want you to have discovered.
That is true. That's sad.
It is sad. And we both know people who have met with the unfortunate ends because of this.
Bill, we have to step away for a break, and when we come back from this break, we'll continue. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back. We're talking this evening with Bill Burns. You know him from television or from his books and perhaps from UFO Magazine, but what a privilege it is to talk with him. Bill, we were talking about the fact that there have been people in the business of getting the word out who have met with very strange deaths.
That's right. There are people people who investigated UFOs in the 1950s, I think Morris K. Jessup was one of them. People who've investigated UFOs, Jonathan Mack was one of them, strangely enough, was hit by a lorry, was hit by a truck because he looked the wrong way crossing a street in the UK. Now, we all know that people tend to look the wrong way if you're from America when you're crossing a street in the UK because traffic comes at you from the opposite direction. We understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that warning even from the police when you're in London about that. We did when we were shooting there. And the strange death of Malachi Martin, who some say was on the inside of the UFO issue, probably for the Vatican.
Yeah, Father Malachi Martin, and he came to prominence in the minds of the general public for most people. By his many appearances on the Art Bell Show.
That's right. Exactly.
And you know, he provided on that show what I would consider to be insider-type information. And you're right. He met with a very, very strange and kind of a, I think people would say, premature death.
Well, he was not a spring chicken. He was in his 70s, but he wasn't especially old. He was a man who was, he was a short kind of, but very spry individual. He had penetrated, at least by his own writing, I mean, this, these were cases that he never really verified for anybody. He penetrated into the world of the unknown with Hostage to the Devil. He spent, however, a great deal of time, and look at who he crossed. He spent a great deal of time documenting scandals within the church, mainly financial scandals. Now, he was living with a woman. He had a mistress. He was basically a priest who had been released from his vows, with the exception of celibacy, which he didn't keep anyway. And he was living with a woman, and he was writing about scandals within the church, but not writing about sexual scandals within the church, writing about financial scandals within the church, at a time when, you remember, the Godfather III was talking about how Pope Paul died, one of the popes had died because of, after 30 days in office, and this was a pope that had said he was going to clean up the financial scandal inside the church, and suddenly in the morning his people go to wake him and he's found dead in bed. Very, very strange. And he was not a sick man. He had no illnesses whatsoever, and he just suddenly mysteriously dies in his sleep. Well, and then there's the Franklin National Bank on Long Island and Miguel Sindona, and that was a scandal with the organized crime families and potentially the Vatican. And here is Malachi Martin talking about this. That was one issue. Some say, and I, you know, I've had it from a source that might be reputable, might be credible, that one of the reasons that he left the ministry was that he was, I'll put this in kind of strange terms, but he was like the Vatican's secret agent. And he was a Jesuit. And he said that the reason he left the clergy, got dispensation from his vows, was because of Vatican II, the Second Vatican Council, and all the church reforms that he said were very new age, very hippie, very high, how do you do, that kind of stuff. On the other hand, what if that were simply a cover? Because here's a guy who had no bones about breaking his vows whenever he wanted to. On the other hand, what if that was a cover? And what if Malachi Martin, because of his fascination with the unknown, his belief in another worldly reality, call it demonic possession, was prepared to accept the reality of an unearthly presence on planet Earth, whatever form that takes, and really became the Vatican's man inside the UFO investigation community on the government end of it. And what if he had come into possession of a fascinating piece of evidence that proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that there had been an extraterrestrial presence on planet Earth for, say, 6 to 7 to 8 thousand years? And he decided that it was time to talk about that.
Now, do you have...
He could open his mouth.
Do you have, or have you had, anyone present information to you that that is the case?
A friend of a friend.
And you think that it may be credible?
Given the description of what that was, yes.
Well, it's pretty interesting, the moves that have been made by the Vatican... really within the last 18 months. You have the statement that by the chief astronomer of the Vatican that, hey, you know, it's okay if you want to think that, that extraterrestrials are real. That doesn't go against church teaching because, after all, they're just our space brothers. So you have that. Then you have this meeting hosted by the Vatican of astronomers and other scientists to talk about extraterrestrial reality. And then, you know, there's this new observatory that the Vatican have, relatively new observatory that they have here in Arizona. And right next to the observatory, a brand new telescope has gone online called Lucifer. And it is a very, very super sensitive binocular optical telescope. And it is it's called Lucifer. Now, it seems that the Vatican is moving toward some kind of disclosure about UFOs, about extraterrestrials. Maybe not, but it seems so. Oh, and then there's also the apology to Galileo. Yeah, what about that? 400 years late, but they did it. So that cleared the way for Catholics to be good Catholics and to think that extraterrestrials are out there, or maybe not out there, but here, but they really exist.
Well, here's what we know. I mean, we know that chunks from space contain life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was spores. Spores can be, but that's life. So life is, so we now know for a scientific fact that life, maybe not sapient life, but at least life, by definition, exists off planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It maybe doesn't exist anymore on Mars, but it once did. The point is that for the church can't circumscribe planet Earth and say only life exists here. They were already caught in that trap when Columbus discovered that there were creatures in the Americas that were not, that the church didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly the church has to embrace them. It is the church's job, it's their job to say that there is no such thing as life in any shape or form that the Creator didn't create. So just as a matter of theological dogma, they must embrace life on other planets or elsewhere in the galaxy or the universe or the solar system, because they can't deny that life when that life has already been discovered. Okay, so that's on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a theological issue, an issue of dogma. In terms of the Vatican investigations of otherworldly realities, the fact that the Vatican recognizes exorcism and recognizes the presence of evil in the world implies that the Vatican recognizes otherworldly life. And of course it has to recognize otherworldly life, again by definition, because all of history, in the Roman Catholic Church at the very least, but in other religions as well, all of history points to a point beyond history, i.e. the Day of Judgment. Judaism, Catholicism, Protestant Christianity, Islam, it all points to a cataclysmic end to existence as we know it, and in some way, shape, or form, a rapture or a Day of Judgment in which all creatures pass before the eye of the Creator. All creatures, by the way, from all time. This is not, oh, on December 21st, 2012. It's when you say beyond history, time stops and all time becomes one. So everyone, everyone, whoever lived, whoever will live, passes before the eye of the Creator to receive judgment, and then there will be a time of peace and harmony, a rapture. Well, given that the whole purpose of religious doctrine and teaching is to prepare human beings, sapient life, for the moment when that life will be judged after history has stopped, means that the church and all religions embrace a non-earthly reality. You could call that reality extraterrestrial. You could call that reality divine, but it is a non-earthly reality. So two out of three big points we now know the Vatican has to embrace, right?
Well, that's true. But, you know, right on the front end of religion, any religion that acknowledges that there is a God, if that God is not from here, that religion must acknowledge the existence of extraterrestrial life.
Of course. They can call them angels. We read about
That's
it in the Bible. We read about it in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. We read about all the angels that are sent by the Creator to us to carry out the Creator's will, from the angel that is sent to guard the Garden of Eden so that Adam and Eve can't go back in, to the angel Jadziel that appears to Abraham telling him not to slay his son Isaac, on and on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, people sometimes look at me like I've gone around the corner and can never come back. When I say, look, if you believe in God, if you believe in the God that's in the Bible, if you think that the Bible's telling you the truth about angels, then you already believe in extraterrestrials because they are not from here.
That's
if they're
right.
not from
exactly.
here, they're extraterrestrial. Bill, we have to step away for break. Folks, we'll be back right after this. Talking with Bill Burns this evening, and Bill, something that occurred to me during the break, and I'm sure our audience would want me to ask this and would expect me to ask this. In producing UFO Hunters, or UFO Hunter, but in producing those episodes, did you ever run across information that was considered just way too sensitive, confirmed information, good solid information, but too sensitive to air, and somewhere up in the network they decided, no, we can't do that?
Yes.
Are you at liberty to talk about any of it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
We basically, this was in Las Vegas, and we were investigating a story that was in UFO magazine, and the story was that there was an object floating over Las Vegas, and this object was somehow a reverse engineered craft from Roswell, okay, for argument's sake. Nobody knew what it was. Somebody was reverse-engineered. And I think the issue was that this person said, oh, look, I discovered this craft. Isn't it fascinating? Why don't you go out and see it? And we covered it in the magazine. We had photographs. Folks can actually get that issue and see photographs of the object. So we went out there. And when we took a 300-millimeter really a huge telescopic camera, huge piece of equipment, and the person who said he could also see it was one of my co-writers and one of my clients as a literary agent, James Sanders, who wrote the books about the missing POWs from the Korean War and World War II in Vietnam. He was in the POW MIA family movement. And he also wrote the book, by the way, The Downing of TWA Flight 800, really showing definitively that it was a United States Navy missile that brought the plane down, that TWA plane down in 1996 over Long Island. He could see the object from his driveway. We went to his driveway, we saw the object, we caught it on camera, then we went up all the way into the National Forest above Las Vegas, and without the light pollution and with a computer program in the camera that was linked to a laptop computer, we could see that we could impose the map of the night sky from that location onto what the camera was seeing. So we know, are we looking at Venus, another planet, the International Space Station? What are we looking at? Well, there was this huge light in the sky, low on the horizon, brighter than the moon, brighter than Venus. Locked up, locked the camera onto it, got some great video of it. Turns out it was kind of a platform. It wasn't a flying saucer or a disc or so. Well, it was a platform. So I texted my office and said, we found it. We found Colonel X's object. When I hit the send button and the text went through, the object slowly began to descend and the lights went out. And people were screaming outside, looking through the camera. Where did it go? What happened? What happened? Well, after we left the area and left Jim Sanders, and Jim Sanders also said, gee, I saw it go. What happened? Where did it go? Light went out. When we left his house, we went back down the mountain, went to Jim's house, couldn't see it, left. As we left, Jim called us on the phone and said, hey, guess what? The object just came back up again. So I asked one of my contacts, former National Security Agency guy, and he said, yeah, you basically tripped onto one of our great assets. It's a listening post. It's a suborbital listening post held aloft by either neutral buoyancy or some kind of anti-gravity that we have. Don't tell me how they got anti-gravity. It is so sensitive, it will scrub, this is Echelon, by the way, it will scrub every piece of email, text mail, phone conversations, name it, it scrubs it.
Mm-hmm.
And it can read your license plates. They saw you coming, they saw you going, they gave you a little lick, they shut it down, and they were funning with you. You tripped into something really big. That segment never aired.
There are lots of bits of information like that that people like you, like me, like Nori, and others come across, and for various reasons that are beyond us, can never be aired. Now you can talk about it, but you couldn't put it on your UFO Hunter show.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, and there are little details that about stories that come to me, and I'm sure to you, that for various reasons, and sometimes actually reasons of safety for the people who are giving us the information, we have to sit on it. We can't broadcast those details because those details, while interesting, may lead right back to them.
That's right. And sometimes those details that you get and that I get, I wanted to say what they are, I could say what they are, but they would lead back to somebody because I'd reveal a specific piece of information that was slipped into what that person was told. A number, a description, a color. The way a lot of espionage agencies, including our own work, is that when they disseminate information, they will disseminate 95% of it truthfully. But in the dissemination, they will insert a piece of disinformation that identifies who would disclose it if it's disclosed.
Yeah.
There are two tricks, there are two gimmicks to the way this thing works, okay? Mm-hmm. And we know this from Area 51. I know this because T.D. Barnes was one of our guests, I'll mention his name, on UFO Hunters, and he worked at Area 51, and he described exactly the way that facility worked when they were working on the A-12, reverse engineering a Russian spy plane, developing the SR-71. He basically said, here's how it works. each of us works in a compartmentalized kind of cubicle. Maybe it's a whole laboratory, but we don't know what the person next door, what Joe or Jane is working on in the next lab. We just don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
It's our job. We focus on it. We turn it in. We're done. The other person turns it in. He or she's done. Then it moves up the line to something else. We may have rumors, hints, bits of information given to us on a need-to-know basis, but we don't know the whole picture. In other words, it's cellular. We're in a cell. So if we're compromised, the whole structure isn't compromised. And that's how they work at Area 51.
Mm-hmm. And like you say, one of the basic tools of counter-espionage is certain amounts of information is going to be known generally among the people who work even in these cellular operations because of little rumors, little leaks, and so forth. So what you do is you make sure that within those you plant something specific that, for instance, if we're going to tell Bill Burns, we plant one specific thing in the information we give to Bill so that we know if that ever comes up, it came from Bill.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. John Schuessler, who was one of the founders of MUFON, was telling us that inside NASA, there are these little cliques, for want of a better term. It sounds high schoolish, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are these little cliques, and these little cliques are called Special Access Project Groups. So if you're seeing, so if an astronaut is seeing a strange object following the space shuttle and reports that, that's not generally disseminated. Oh, wow, guys, look, Jim Lovell found a UFO. No, that goes to special access projects. And special access projects may link with another special access project in another branch of the Defense Department, the State Department, wherever.
Bill, I hate to do it. We have to step away. A break just took over, and in 30 seconds, your mic and mine will go dead. We'll be back, and we'll pick up there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in the second hour of the show, my deepest sympathy to you for having missed the first hour. My guest this evening is Bill Burns, and we welcome you. We're glad you're here. We will open the telephone lines for the audience in just a few minutes, but we have a couple of things to cover before then. And very quickly, let me tell you that following tonight's show, in our members area, those of you who are watching on our TV channel, there will be a special presentation. So what will happen is the live stream will go off as normal. Just stay tuned because within a few seconds, the special presentation will start. I think you'll like it. All right, back to our guest, Bill Burns. Bill, we were talking about this special access group in NASA, and the break took over, and we had to step away. They're automated, so they happen at the same time every night, and we just have to comply. But you were talking about what happens, for instance, if an astronaut sees something, some object following or flying near the shuttle. It goes to the special access group, and then what happens after that?
The special access group, which is also compartmentalized,
mm-hmm.
and it's a hierarchy, they will assess that information. Just like it is so similar, at least in my mind, to serial killer investigations. And I keep making that analogy because UFOs are just like serial killers. They hide in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
And when police agencies, in various major police agencies, I'm not talking about Mayberry RFD, I'm talking about a major police agency, they will have certain group, not so much a serial killer group, but something like that, that will deal with cases that break across certain jurisdictions and in some cases may require the intervention of the FBI. So state police agencies, large, like Los Angeles County Sheriff, I'm sure the Phoenix Police Department, Maricopa County, things like that. And what they will do is, even though Officer Joe walking the beat won't know that information, somebody very high up in the police command will have, with special training, will be able to talk to his or her counterpart in another state, in Seattle, in King County, in New York City, in Philly, and a counterpart at the Bureau of at the Behavioral Science Unit at the FBI in Quantico. The point is, they will communicate and share information at that level. Well, the same is true with special access groups. There is a special access office in the Pentagon run by the Deputy Secretary or the Undersecretary of Defense. We know who they are. We don't know which one it is in any given administration, but we know who it was in the Bush administration. The point is, it will run to that person. And through that office, it will be coordinated, whether it's a CIA director, whether it's someone in a national security liaison position, which is what Corso was in back in the Eisenhower administration. That person will have access to that information, and traffic, whether it's cable traffic, email traffic, hard copy traffic, will pass through those bureaus. And that's how the information is shared. When the information is disseminated, it will contain bits and pieces of false identifiers. Those identifiers identify the person who's getting the information. The person doesn't know what the identifier is, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It could say that the object glowed blue, or the object glowed golden or red. Well, you don't know if you're receiving the information whether that's true or false. You just know the object glowed, right? Mm-hmm. So if you say, oh, that object was a golden glowing object, immediately, hey, Jane Smith over in NASA Ames blurted that out. Now you're out of the loop, and you get a very stern warning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is standard counterintelligence, basic counterintelligence procedure. So you would expect that it would be used on the topic of UFOs. Now, let me ask you this very quickly, and then we'll open up the telephone lines. Do you think that we really need for the government to disclose anything?
Do we really need, is the question, do I think we really need for the government to disclose anything?
Yeah, about UFOs.
No. About UFOs, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the government will disclose. I think disclosure has already happened, if you want to know the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that for anybody who takes the blinders off, I believe what's going on is something like this. Take the 1952 UFO flap. I mean, how much more obvious can you get?
You're referring to the fleet of UFOs that flew over the Capitol on two successive Saturdays.
Captured on film.
Yeah.
With live witnesses attesting to what happened, going in movies, and say Al Chop at the Pentagon, Edward Ruppelt, head of Blue Book, Major Kehoe, all eyewitnesses. Now here's the point, Kevin: they're eyewitnesses, not just to.
We thought this might happen. Now, Bill, if you can hear me, let me tell you, somebody just shut your audio off. So if you can hear me, we will reestablish contact with you. Look, he and I talked about this today on the telephone. I said, look, it could happen. It happens sometimes where they just shut somebody's audio down. And so we'll see if we can get him back on the line. We'll see if this works. I don't know if we'll be able to get him back, but we'll give it a try.
You know, I wish I could say that was the government intervening.
Okay.
I wish I could say that.
What happened?
But that would be a lie. That was me dropping a phone. I wish I could say that. But just getting back to this, because I know we want to get to the callers, but in this particular case, and I'm sorry I dropped the phone, in this particular case, you had Edwin Roosevelt, Donald Kehoe. The important thing about that, at least in my mind, and this goes right to the answer to your question, is not just that there were UFOs over Washington at caught on film, but that the process of the cover-up was documented by the very people who were witnessing it. The process of cover-up, just like the Walter Hout memo that Tom Carey and Donald Schmidt got the Walter Hout family to agree to release, documented the process of cover-up of Roswell. It's the process that fascinated me. So, do I think that UFOs have been disclosed, their existence? Yes, I do. I think they've been disclosed over and over and over again. Do I think we know what planet they're from or what dimension or time zone? No, I have my guesses, but I don't know. But is the process of an otherworldly, a not-of-this-reality object been disclosed? Yes. And what has happened? The government has said, who are you going to believe? Are you going to believe your government when we tell you it's a radar inversion, a radar anomaly, a temperature inversion, a balloon? Or are you going to believe your own lying eyes and your own lying ears? Well, unfortunately, in the national security state, post-World War II national security state, unfortunately, most people believe the government. Because why trust your own lying eyes and your own lying ears?
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
I,
you know,
A, we had disclosure. B, the government's not going to do it. C, we don't need it.
Yeah, I am in full agreement with you. I make a point of saying this sometimes, that, you know, how many people have seen a cow? Everybody. Okay, now how many people have ever seen a cow and then allowed someone to convince them it was a Cadillac? Nobody. We don't allow that kind of nonsense in any other part of our minds except when it comes to UFOs. And then we'll let the government tell us, oh, it was Chinese candles, or it was weather balloons, or it was hallucinations. And we know that's not what we saw. We know for sure that isn't what we know what we saw. We may not know exactly what it is. We may not know where it's from. But we know it wasn't
right.
Flares. We know it wasn't Chinese candles. And we know it wasn't a weather balloon. All right, let's open up the telephone line and allow the audience to participate with us. And let me give the telephone numbers out very quickly, ladies and gentlemen. The main number here in the studio, and you can call this number from anywhere on planet Earth and probably from planet Nibiru as well. It is 623-444-5889. Again, that's 623-444-5889. Now, in the USA and Canada, if you need to call me on the toll-free line, you may do so. It is 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, I don't have international toll-free. Tried to get it. Can't find it. But I've got something else for you. And what you can do is you can call our main number or you can send me a flash message. And you do that by going to my website. Scroll down under Bill's photograph. You'll see a link that says Flash Message. Just click that, and you can send your comment or question that way. All right, to the telephone now. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan in Washington.
Hi, Ryan.
I'll just ask my question and let the other callers call in. Bill, it's an honor to speak with you. I wish your show still in the air. I enjoyed it. Can you please pick apart these two bozos over there in Bordertown, New Jersey, who tried to write off that whole investigation as flares with balloons, and this is a sloppy job of doing it? Can you
sure
set the facts straight on that? And I'll just take it off the air.
All right, thanks Ryan.
Okay, I can. I will. Thank you, Ryan. And I was going to give Kevin Smith, and I'll do it right now, a big hat tip for covering that, all the way back last year when it happened. And here's what happened. This is a classic case of hoaxing the media without hoaxing us. Mm-hmm. First of all, whatever, and this was Rudy and Russo, Joe and Chris, I think their names were. It never happened. What happened was they said, maybe they lit off flares, but the point was they were doing it as an April Fool's, they were doing it as a joke, and they were doing it. We covered this, not as an episode. That's mistake number one. Oh, we hoaxed UFO Hunters doing an episode. Nope. That was a last-minute thing. The day before, we were supposed to move out to our first location. The network asked me, Bill, can you do a quick promo? There were some lights up in northern New Jersey, up in Morris Township. Can you just interview some folks? And if we can fit this into the first episode, we will. If we can't, we won't. But we're going to use it right now as a promotion, not an episode. So we used a different crew. And we used a different crew, and we used a different crew with a different camera. And because of that, we couldn't intercut this into the first episode we were doing, which was Giant Triangles in Northern California. So that intercutting was out, just based on equipment itself. So it turned into a promotion for the series. In the promotion for the series, the point was to go up to Morristown, New Jersey, because I live in New Jersey, go up there, interview the witnesses, this little girl, this pilot, and the Hanover Township, and the, one of the township health officers, environmental officers. What did you see, et cetera, et cetera. Show us some video. Let's take it back to the lab and have it analyzed. Well, it never made it back to the lab. Joan Chris had said that they were lighting off balloons with candles attached by fishing line, which we did. This was our episode in Tinley Park.
Well, actually, they said it was flares.
They said it was flares, which we did in Tinley Park. That was the whole point. We did that as an episode in the first episode of season two in Tinley Park, Illinois. So they were going to debunk that episode. We never called it a flying saucer. I never said, oh, wow, it's a craft from outer space. What I said was, looking at it, first of all, we asked the witnesses, what did you see? Were, did they look like flares to you? And all the witnesses, including a pilot, said no. The pilot showed me the video. And on the video, I said, it doesn't look, on the video, the lights looked as if they were attached to a rigid structure. And we said, the Hanover Township Police have already said that these are flares attached to balloons. So he gave the official statement. So, well, let's take it back to the lab and see what they are. Can't tell from the video what they are. That suddenly became, on April 1st, April Fool's Day, oh, we hoaxed UFO Hunters. So what they did was they first went to MUFON, filed a false UFO sighting report. Okay? So instead of a social experiment, they're filing a false report to trick MUFON. Well, if you file a report, you file a report. MUFON caught on because the emails didn't match the names. So they said it was a hoax. The Hanover Township Police said it was a hoax. We said, let's take it back to the lab and investigate. That became their hoax on the media because they told the media, again, a false press release. It was a lie. Mm-hmm. They said to the media, we hoaxed UFO Hunters by getting them to say it was a UFO. Well, think about this for a second. If you don't know what it is, and it's a light in the sky that you're seeing on a video, it's unidentified. If it's flying, it's flying. If it looks like an object, it looks like an object. By definition, it's an unidentified flying object. Not a flying saucer, not a spacecraft. You don't know what it is, which is what we said. We don't know what this is. It's unidentified. So the media picked up on the fact that all UFOs are flying saucers, which they're not.
Well, you know, the lamestream media are dipsticks. Lamestream media are a bunch of dipsticks anyway.
They are dipsticks. So the media picked up on it. So this became a media hoax, which is continuing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did a series on that, and I, from the standpoint of a cop that gathers information, and then you have to look at what could be evidence for a crime, what could be evidence that you could introduce in court, etc. I showed that what they're using for evidence, that evidence saying that they did a hoax, won't stand up. They can't even use their own evidence and prove they hoaxed it.
That's right.
Okay, back to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, this is Leah.
Ooh, Leah, we can barely hear you. Can you speak directly into your telephone?
I'm hearing you, too.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, Bill, on your episodes, there was one where you had two men that were having similar experiences, and they had blood that was being tested. They had similar oddities to it, and it was the last conclusion was that this should be tested with more abductees to see if there any more had the same oddities. Whatever came of those two, and any conclusions?
Well, it's fascinating. It's Michael and Terrell. And Michael and Terrell will be my guests on a radio show upcoming very soon. They both did have the CK, this high kind of strange protein. And other people who have claimed to have been abducted, UFO abductions, alien abductions, have also had this. Terrell has gone on to meet with a group of people who say they are hybrid creatures, and they're being taught what the nature of their hybrid existence is, and he will talk about that. And Michael has gone on to explore his own family, and from our show, he found his biological mother, who indeed had anomalous experiences and had the same blood disorder that Michael had. And he met up with his father, who is a very famous rock musician, and hopes to ask him the same question. His mother was a roadie, and his father was a very famous rock musician. I'm not going to disclose who he is, but he was a very famous rock musician. You'd all know who he is. That is the person Michael's mother said was Michael's father. He is fascinated by UFOs, this rock musician. Totally fascinated, and Michael wants to find out if his father, his biological father, has the same blood condition that he has. But they have gone on with their lives. They're close friends now, and they are exploring this background that they share.
Wow. All right. Let's... the phone lines are open, folks, if you wish to call. Let's go to a flash message from Columbia. Peter writes, one of my favorite UFO Hunters episodes was the Dulce episode. Really excellent. I would like to hear if there was anything interesting cut out or planned that did not make it into the broadcast version. For example, I was surprised that one of the major investigators of Dulce was completely omitted, at least in the version I saw. I'm referring to Greg Bishop. Why wasn't he included, and do you have any additional info on the weird embryo?
Well, there are three questions. Let's get to the three answers. One, I don't know why I was not in show. We were on the road, and our production staff back at the office were the ones that handled the guests, and my thinking was that Greg had a schedule conflict and could not get out there, and we already had John Rhodes and Ken Storch and Bob X, so we were filled with witnesses. So that's, I guess, they could not coordinate with Greg, who is a friend, and we're going to have him on the show as well to talk about that. But that was that answer. Answer two is, were there things cut out? Yes, there was a major part of the story cut out. The tribal elders that we met with, the Jicarilla Apache tribal elders, that whole area was filled with shadow people, strange little childlike entities. Nobody knows where they came from, but the Native Americans, the Apache, were seeing them and wanted to show us the shadow people. One of our crew members saw one and absolutely freaked out. And that was such a heavy shock that we never included those conversations that we had or went out to see the shadow people, which I wanted to see. The other thing that was cut out was there were vents in the mountain at Dulce, in the Archuleta Mesa, And if you put a mic, your ear or a microphone up to those vents, you would hear groans. Our Native American guide would not take us there because he was afraid to disclose where those vents were. And did anything else come of the photos of the embryo? Yes. We found the vet who was given that fetus, that hybridized fetus, cow and human, and he basically said he would not talk to us, he would not give us a piece of that. He basically said the consequences that would fall upon not just him, but his cousin, who was the state trooper, the retired state trooper, and the entire Jicarilla Apache would be too grave for him to be so irresponsible as to give us a piece. And sure enough, that episode stepped on so many toes, not of extraterrestrials, but of the military and big pharmaceutical companies doing something that prompted Senators Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell, I forget who the third person, Chuck Grassley, to introduce in the Senate a bill to amend Title 18, the U.S. Penal Code, to make it a criminal offense to mix human and animal DNA.
All right, we have to step away for break. Caller, are you willing to hang on through the break?
Yes.
All right, hang in there. We'll get to you right after this. And welcome back. We're talking with Bill Burns, William J. Burns, and we have a caller on the line, so let's go to our caller. And caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin from Beaverton.
Hello, Kevin.
Bill, I was wondering if Kevin, the UFO hunter that came in during some point in the series, was brought in to be a skeptic on the show, or just happened to have the right credentials and just happened to be a skeptic?
No, he was actually brought in, believe it or not. It's Kevin Cook, and he's really a nice guy. He's a real sweetie pie. We really liked him. Kevin was brought in as the engineer, and what people never understood, because that was like not part of his mission. He was brought in. Kevin was a stage musician when he was in college, and he really does believe in some aspects of the paranormal, sleight of hand, and he was fascinated by the whole subject, and really was working against what he believed in as we did this, because he was really the guy who was supposed to throw cold water on stuff because of his engineering background, because his basis is how things fit together. So the network wanted that kind of a person on the show because Ted Ackworth, our science guy, just had a baby, and he just couldn't get on the road as much as they wanted. He couldn't spend those weeks in Europe that we spent. So he had to leave the show for his own reasons. And so that's why they brought on Kevin. Kevin had experience on camera with Smash Lab, so that was another asset. He didn't have to learn how to stand in front of a camera.
All right, Kevin, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for the call. All right, let's go to a flash message now from Ross in the United Kingdom. He says, hi, Ross here from Scotland. At the moment, the pyramid of power stops with the people that pull the strings of the government. The moment they admit publicly that there are living beings on other planets and that they have visited us, they have lost their position at the top of the pyramid. They lose their control of the masses. By letting out tidbits here and there and allowing the cover-ups and disinfo to be documented, they are disclosing to those who are switched on enough to realize it. Just my two cents. Okay.
Well, I think it's a very valuable 2 cents or 2 pence. I think that that's partly true, mm-hmm. that the implication is so great of our connection with otherworldly creatures that it would be overwhelming to us. I think there's a much... I don't think it's just about UFOs. That's where I part company with a lot of the disclosure people. I just don't think it's about the UFOs or even about the creatures in the UFOs. I think it's so much bigger and so much more encompassing about the nature of who we are as a species and our relationship to other realities that it would be stunning for us. And here's the analogy that I'm giving for our friend in Scotland, and it's simply this. When the Israelites, look at the Bible, when the Israelites were freed in Exodus from Egypt and they went into the desert, they were shown the promised land. When the spies from the various tribes entered the promised land to speck it out, to spy it out, they came back so overwhelmed by what they saw, huge giants in the earth, the Nephilim, descendants of the Nephilim, right? Grapes as big as basketballs. They were so stunned, they said, we could never occupy this land. We will be slaughtered. Let's go back to Egypt and die as slaves. And our Creator realized at that point that his people were not, they had the slave mentality. They were ready to be slaves rather than enter the promised land. Therefore, they had to linger in the wilderness for 40 more years until all the people who had been slaves in Egypt died, and their children, who no longer had a slave mentality, could enter the promised land and do what they had to do to occupy it, as was the promise in Genesis. We are the same. We are not, our mentality, believe it or not, will not allow us to accept the profound truth of our relationship to this otherworldly, whatever it is, this otherworldly reality. Hence, a new generation, maybe a hybridized generation, maybe the crystal children, I don't know, but another generation can only accept it. And so, little tidbits will dribble out. We will be gradually, we will be given very gradually bits of information. A tipping point will occur, and there will be kind of a realization among us, like a flock mentality, that something is there and what it is we will discover. But the point is, it will not be handed to us like something from the mound.
Good analogy. Okay, to the telephone caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Mike from Kentucky.
Hello, Mike.
Hello. Hello.
And, Bill, you had a case on your show where this gentleman observed this triangle or delta-shaped object fluttering along above a stream in his backyard down behind his house as though it were in trouble. And it went along that stream, then when it came to a bridge, it just rose straight up, went across the bridge, and it went back down and followed on out till it disappeared. You remember that case?
Yes, I do.
Well, I investigated a case in 1989 where a gentleman lived in Jackson, Tennessee at the time, and he went out and looked his backyard, and there was a lot of people standing around the neighborhood, and there was this ball or sphere, and it had come down and was running across the ground much in the same way as that thing was until it came to a tree. It stopped, went up across the tree, went back down, continued on to the end of the field, turned and came back like it was surveying the land. And yours was, that's the only report that the one you gave that I'd ever heard that was anything like this one.
Well, the difference I think between the two reports is that the object that this person saw in Texas going along that riverbed, that streambed, that was followed, escorted, not chased, escorted by two F-16s.
Exactly.
And so it was clearly an escort situation, and it led us to believe either that we were so much in league with whatever was flying that extraterrestrial craft that it was kind of part of us. It was flying in formation. Or the craft itself was one of ours that we were experimenting with. It was heading toward a NASA base, right? It was heading toward Johnson Space Center, toward a NASA base,
right.
And it was being escorted by F-16s.
It was sort of similar to the Cash Landrum case.
The Cash Landrum case, I think, was not an extraterrestrial object. From what I found out from folks who worked at Task Force 160, whose Chinook helicopters escorted that object, was a nuclear reactor that had gone hot and had to be dumped out in the Gulf.
Weird. Okay, Mike, thanks for the call. So where was this nuclear reactor? Was it in some kind of a craft, or was it just being carried?
We had been experimenting in the earlier 1970s with personnel carriers that were powered by small nuclear reactors, and we just didn't get it right, Kevin. We just could never... Maybe it's right now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But back then, back 30-plus years ago, we couldn't get it right. These reactors would overheat. They would go... they would actually start a meltdown function, and we would have to get rid of them. And the only group that could be assembled quickly was in 1980. Remember, Task Force 160 was formed, Delta Force and Task Force 160, and the Intelligence Support Activities Group were formed after the debacle of Jimmy Carter's attempt to free the hostages from Tehran, from the Tehran embassy, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And no unit in that politically correct rescue mission could talk to each other on the same radios or anything. So we formed an integrated unit called Task Force Project 160. And that was the group that flew that object over Texas, over the Cash Landrum vehicle into the Gulf.
Okay, let's go back to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Dominic from Toronto, Canada calling.
Hello, Dominic.
How are you?
Good.
Great show, like always.
Thank you.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
UFO Hunters is becoming in syndication in Canada starting May 31st, so I'm excited
to
catch up on the... on the episode. So my question is, since you find Colonel Corso credible, I did read his book and I found it to be very interesting. People like myself are confused when you have credible researchers like Stanley Friedman who don't find them to be credible. How does the general public basically accept that when we're being torn by two different groups on people like Bob Lazar and Corso?
Well, Bob Lazar and Corso were two very different individuals, just in terms of their backgrounds and records. I think the expert on Bob Lazar is George Knapp, and George Knapp has said that he found corroborating documents for Bob Lazar. What we don't know now is Bob Lazar, because he was in so much trouble with the government, is he cooperating to the extent that he's not talking that much, that some of his story was really, some of it was hoaxed to him, set up to him so that if he spoke to anybody, they would know, the powers that be would know where that stuff came from. Corso was different. Corso was entirely credible with respect to his military record. He did exactly and was exactly where he said he was when he was saying he was there, right? He was with MacArthur. He was targeting nuclear beta. He was doing nuclear targeting for MacArthur. He did Little Switch, Big Switch for President Eisenhower. He was on Ike's national security staff. He did have nuclear weapons at his disposal in Europe in the late 1950s. And whatever he saw at Red Canyon, he saw at Red Canyon. The issue isn't who Corso was. The issue is did Corso do what he said he did? And was what Corso said happened, did it actually happen? And I believe that in some instances that we did have reverse engineering, because I've seen corroborating material. In fact, I published it in UFO Magazine so anybody could see it, from Corso's boss, Arthur Trudeau, who absolutely said that the Army R&D office came into possession of material, not invented here. And he went to Strom Thurmond on the Armed Services Committee looking for money for his budget to develop this. And Strom Thurmond said, no, Art, Arthur Trudeau, no, Art, you're not going to get a dime out of the Senate. You're not going to get a dime out of the Senate unless you take the not invented heres and you make them invented heres by getting patents for U.S. defense contractors, which is the heart and soul of what Corso said happened. Now, the difference is that Trudeau never said it came from Roswell. He's not going to disclose that information. He disclosed other mind-boggling information. By the way, it's not classified. You can all get it.
Bill, we have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Caller, thanks for the call. We'll get the rest of that answer on the air. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back. My guest this evening is Bill Burns. And Bill, when we had to step away for break, you were talking with us about Trudeau and what he had to say and how that fit with what Corso said.
Well, the fact is that Corso, in fact, might, I think what Corso talked about happened. What we don't know is actually what part of it is what Corso did and what part of it is what somebody else did. And I think that's what Stan Friedman was talking about. That's exactly what Stan's issue was. Not that reverse engineering never took place, but that was Corso's story an amalgamation of what other people did, including Corso, or was it all Corso? And the fact is that we have no way of knowing. All we know is that Arthur Trudeau corroborates Corso's story that there were not material not invented here, that Army R&D with its budget took to defense contractors. We know that after this moment in time in Army R&D in 1961 and 62, there was really a golden age of technology in the mid-1960s, partly based on what Corso says were things that came from Roswell. We also know that it was only after the Roswell crash that Bertin and Shockley, who were working on the transistor for over 10 years, suddenly, in a matter of weeks, had a transistor and patented it at the end of that year and again in the following year. So circumstantial evidence says something happened. Was it as Corso said it was? All we have is Corso's word.
Very quickly, let me make an observation. Then we're going to do a flash message and then take a call, and we'll probably be out of time then. Okay, caller, just hang on. We'll get to you. All right, my observation is, as international police officer, there was a point for most of that time, I was in a position of command, either of a unit or of the entire operations of the entire mission. And if I were to tell you about something that went on, and if I were to say, well, I did this, it would be true. However, it is obviously true that I personally could not possibly do everything related to a mission. I'm giving orders for people to do this part and to do that part. Where did it originate? From me. It's proper for me to say that I did this. It's also proper for the people who actually were on the ground following the orders to say they did it. So I don't see a problem with Corso saying that he did something if, in fact, it was done on his orders. Then he did it as much as the person who carried out the order. So
I couldn't agree with you more.
Okay. Very quickly, from Kevin in Australia. Kevin has two questions, but we don't have time for both. I'm going to select one. He says, what's your thought on or your thoughts on the comments made by Stephen Hawking's warning about alien contact.
I think Stephen Hawking is probably correct. I think for those people who are talking about meeting with our space brothers, and this, by the way, Kevin, goes all the way back to the 1950s with George Adamski, George Van Tassel, Howard Menger, Frank Stranges. Sure, I'm sure there are benevolent entities out there. In fact, there are people who spoke about, I mean, I'm getting conversations now with people talking about these benevolent human beings, okay? However, what Stephen Hawking is talking about is not just sapient creatures. He's talking about the fact that we don't know, and it's a standard military practice that you ask, friend or foe? And if that's not a friend, if the transponder on a plane, the friend or foe transponder, doesn't come back, that it's a friend, you have to assume that it's a foe just to protect yourself. And that's really what Stephen Hawking is saying. He's saying we go rushing into some other place and trip into another culture and suddenly expose our reality. You don't know what you're exposing it to.
That is true. And plus, he is also correct in that such contact with any race, any civilization that is far advanced of us, will definitely have sociological impact and make huge changes in our sociology and in our culture. But, you know, that for me, that reason is not something to fear. The same thing happened when the steam locomotive came along. The same thing happened, you know, when there was the first man in space. It made huge changes in our sociology.
Let me throw some things at you. Mm-hmm. I just real quick, and I know we're running out of time. If you, Kevin Smith, were the president of the United States, and you knew, not guessed, knew that disclosure would be so fundamentally earth-shaking, let's just say one of two things, for argument's sake, there might be many more. Either we human beings, just like Zechariah Sitchin has said, are a manufactured slave race, that everything we believe is wrong, would you as president tell us that? Or what if we were actually locked, what if the creatures we're talking about that are human are actually part of a grand universal plan for us as either a slave race or a primitive race, locked in kind of a time travel loop, and our whole sense of self-determination is a false reality? Would you as president tell us that?
Well, I don't know if I was president whether I would do it. I, as talk show host, do it.
You're a journalist. As a talk show host,
that's
your
different
job.
That's different. As president,
different.
I don't know. It would be a tough call.
Right.
Speaking of calls, let's get this one very quick. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's Terry from Ohio.
Okay. Terry, you have to make it real quick, and then the answer will have to be quick because we're out of time.
I typically talked on Kevin's show where you did an episode where a guy tried to simulate what they were seeing in space, like when they did that Teller thing and he did his pencils thing, and that was the closest thing I've ever seen, you know, of actually imitating what somebody actually saw, whether it's real or not.
You're going to have to ask your question. We're out of time.
Ain't close. I just wondered what he thought about that.
Okay.
Is this a remote viewing question? Because remote viewing is absolutely real. Paul Smith was a remote viewer. He did remote view our UFO, our flying saucer, landing on Saturn's moon Cassini. And he traveled forward in time by 20 years.
Okie dokie. All right. Terry, thanks for the call. I'm sorry I had to rush everybody, but the clock is unforgiving, and we are just about out of time. Bill, I want to thank you for being with me And if you will, stay on the line with me for a moment. I'd like to talk with you after we close the show. Wow. Thanks, Bill. Just fabulous, fabulous. All right, now, folks, if you are a member of the Kevin Smith Show and you're watching on our television channel, as soon as we clear off the air, just hang in there. We've got a special feature for you. I think you'll enjoy it. And just keep your browser open and keep watching, because it will come on. Folks, there is far more to know than there is known. And it's people like Bill Burns who are going out and actually investigating this stuff that are digging up the information that we need to know. And thankfully, through his books and through television, he has brought it back to us and put a lot of that information in front of us. He's doing a fabulous job, and there are others out there doing fabulous jobs as well. You meet them here at the Kevin Smith Show. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.